From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Pennsylvania Senator Harris Wofford. His election to the U.S. Senate last year was considered the first sign that the Republicans might be vulnerable in the 1992 presidential race. Wofford's campaign was managed by James Carville, who went on to run the Clinton campaign. Also today, The Crying Game. We talk with Irish writer and director Neil Jordan about his new movie. His other movies include Mona Lisa, The Company of Wolves, and The Miracle. And some early forgotten moments of TV history resurface this weekend. You can see a pre-Sean Connery James Bond and Carl Reiner starring in the forerunner of The Dick Van Dyke Show. David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today in Little Rock, President-elect Bill Clinton reacted to the latest economic figures. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton called the latest revision in the gross national product, 4% growth in the third quarter instead of 2.7, good news. Asked whether the stronger-than-expected performance would cause him to change his plans for economic stimulus or deficit reduction, he said he wanted to analyze the figures further. He said manufacturing was still in trouble, and the more politically important indicator of employment could still suffer from recent layoffs at Boeing and General Motors.
My long-term strategy won't be changed at all. It could have some impact on short-term judgment, but we're going to have to try to see whether basically, these figures tell us anything about what's likely to happen for the next year.
In the past, Clinton has said he'd be willing to boost the deficit in the short term with an economic stimulus package unless the economy improved significantly by early 1993. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Army said today that it has withdrawn a $594 million contract for research on part of the proposed Star Wars anti-missile system. An Army statement said that budget constraints forced it to cancel the contract with McDonnell Douglas Corporation and four of its major subcontractors. The contract was for development of the so-called ground-based surveillance and tracking system. The GSTS program was intended to construct a single high-tech headquarters base somewhere in the United States that would be the heart of a system to find, track, and support attacks on incoming missiles. Czechoslovakia's parliament has approved the breakup of the country as of January 1st. The breakup appeared inevitable, but today's decision allows it to go ahead with legitimacy. Burton Bolag reports from Prague.
According to today's decision, Czechoslovakia will cease to exist as of midnight on December 31st. In its place will be two successor states, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. After failing to win approval on two previous occasions, the bill only just scraped through today with the 3/5 majority needed. The opposition, both the left wing and the far right, had insisted that the country's split up could only be approved by the people in a referendum, but their position was not accepted. Meanwhile, the Czech and Slovak republics have already agreed to almost all the major issues around their separation, including dividing up federal property and the army. So, as of January 1st, and in negotiated and even friendly circumstances, 74-year-old Czechoslovakia will cease to exist. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 3,266. Advances led declines by a margin of 10-7 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Exchange was 206 million shares. This is NPR. The UN Security Council is debating whether to authorize the use of military force to defend relief shipments in Somalia. Under the plans being discussed, UN troops would be authorized to shoot to prevent looting. There are now about 500 Pakistani UN troops in Somalia, but their mission has been limited to occupying the Mogadishu airport. About 3,000 more peacekeepers have been authorized for Somalia, but UN officials have not been able to negotiate agreements with Somali warlords to allow them into the country. New York City Mayor David Dinkins gave a live television and radio address today in an effort to calm weeks of racial tensions between himself and members of the Jewish community. NPR's Maria Inahosa reports.
A somber David Dinkins spoke for about 10 minutes, pleading for the racial bickering and name-calling to stop. The most recent tensions were set off by last month's acquittal of a black teenager for the murder of a Hasidic man. The murder occurred during riots in August of 1991 in Brooklyn that were sparked when a black child was killed in an accident involving a Hasidic driver. Many in the Hasidic community claimed the mayor was responsible for the Jewish man's death, and protests were held calling for his resignation. Dinkins' speech today was a personal appeal to put a stop to the divisions.
Today I speak for all New Yorkers. The spinning wheel of accusation has made its last turn. Our city will not be divided. Race baiters and rabble-risers do not understand our lives.
Critics say the mayor has not done enough, but today the mayor outlined a 5-point plan to deal with the racial tensions. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
British lawmakers voted today to freeze their own pay, in keeping with the government's calls for wage restraint. The country's 651 members of parliament had been scheduled for a 3.9% raise. Instead, lawmakers in the House of Commons voted overwhelmingly to keep their pay at its current level of just over $47,000 a year. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last year, my guest Harris Wofford won the Pennsylvania race for U.S. Senate. This Democratic victory was considered the first sign that President Bush was vulnerable. Wofford's campaign helped set the tone for the Clinton campaign. Wofford's opponent, Richard Thornburgh, had been Bush's attorney general. When the Senate race began, Wofford was over 40 points behind in the polls. His successful campaign was run by James Carville, who managed Clinton's campaign after Wofford's victory. Wofford is in his mid-60s, but this was the first time he ever ran for office. He had served in the Kennedy administration, where he was the president's special assistant for civil rights and co-founder of the Peace Corps. In the 70s, Wofford was the president of Bryn Mawr College. He later worked in the administration of Pennsylvania Governor Bob Casey. There's a new edition of Wofford's 1980 book about his work with the Kennedys and Martin Luther King called Of Kennedys and Kings. Wofford was with the Peace Corps in Africa when Kennedy was assassinated. I asked him how he got the news.
We got the call from a friend who had heard the radio at the embassy, and it was unbelievable. I tried to hitch a ride on the emperor's plane to come back for the funeral. I heard he was leaving in his big jet, and I came down from our mountain in a jeep, and I changed into a suit from work clothes in the car. And I knew they'd let me on because the emperor had a very warm spot in his heart for the Peace Corps, and I'd worked well with him. And they let us go out onto the runway. The jet was there, and we were rushing out on the runway. And just as our jeep was 100 yards from the plane, it swooped off and took off, and I didn't make it.
Oh, you must have been upset.
I would rather have been at the funeral.
Last year, you ran for office for the first time. After having served in the Kennedy administration in Pennsylvania, you served in Governor Bob Casey's administration. You've been the president of Bryn Mawr College, a university professor. But this was the first time that you actually ran for office.
Right.
You won in a kind of surprising victory because you ran against Dick Thornburgh.
I started 47 points down.
Right.
Ended 10 points up.
Why in your 60s did you decide to run for office for the first time?
Well, like John Kennedy, how did you become a hero? He said, they sank my boat. We had a terrible tragedy in the loss of John Hines, and I had out of that an opportunity, I hope, to make something good come out of the tragedy. I got appointed, and once appointed, I wanted to see through the job. I relished the campaign and the chance to earn the seat, which I was the first bird of spring for the change that is coming now. And when people sent me up, they weren't sure that I'd get through. But I signaled, I didn't create the change, but I signaled that there's a winter of discontent that people felt. And I helped ride that wave of discontent, which is now the challenge of the president-elect to turn into something creative.
Now, James Carville headed your campaign, and of course he afterwards went to work for the Clinton campaign. And the strategy that he used on your campaign was obviously very successful, and I think he pursued a similar strategy with the Clinton campaign. Tell me why you decided to hire him.
Well, I'd seen him in action in the Bob Casey campaign. I was chairman of the Democratic Party, another odd thing for me to have done, but in 86...
This is in the state of Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, excuse me. I was asked... We were sitting in Pennsylvania, and you were reaching the whole country. I was Pennsylvania state chairman, and we hired James Carville to be the campaign chief and Paul Begala. And I saw that team in action, and I thought they were the kind of coaches that would be very good for me, who had not run before. And one of the things they do best is what you need to do in interviews, I'm sure. The danger for someone like me, they felt, and they felt this way about Clinton, is that we're interested in a lot of different ideas and have done a lot of things and pursue ideas, and we could talk about those all over the map of Pennsylvania or the United States. And Carville's main message to a candidate is the discipline of the message. One day I finally told him that I understand it, because a few years ago I read all of Lincoln's speeches from the Lincoln-Douglas debates to the first inaugural, and they were on one subject: how to save the Union without expanding slavery, or how to check slavery without destroying the Union. He argued and re-argued it. It was the most disciplined of the message campaign in our history. And that's what Carville urges you to do. And he helped me pick the key issues of our economy and health care. And he's done the same with Clinton.
Yeah, with Clinton, it was the economy. With you, I think the main focus was probably health care.
And the economy.
And the economy. So what were the most compelling things he said to you about the importance of keeping a focus, of limiting the number of issues you're going to talk about during the campaign?
Well, he helped make clear to me how the people. James has got a lot of touch with the whole range of different people that make up the people. How the people are so inundated with information that you've got to go through the opening where it is, and you've got to go through it hard and clear. They don't all love politics. People are ready for the ball game or any number of other things. And so you've got to go through that narrow opening where people are ready to, with all their skepticism, to think, well, maybe this fellow's better than the other, or maybe this is a time we can use the ballot to change things. It doesn't usually happen, but maybe. And you've got to seize that moment and to do it clearly and with one, two, three issues. And he also turned my mind around on this question of the 30-second television ads, which I've always thought were abominable. And yet, it was those ads, not my debate with Dick Thornburg, that reached the homes of everybody in Pennsylvania. And he said, instead of having puff stuff about you or negative stuff about the opponent, go on those ads and show what you believe. And just the fact you're fighting and believing in something will let them know who you are better than puff stuff about you were president of Bryn Mawr or things like this.
Well, let me ask you about those ads. One of the ads, and this was about about health insurance. It said, at a time when government seems to care about everyone in the world but us, Harris Wofford says, it's time to take care of Americans again. It's time to take care of our own. That's an interesting statement coming from someone who, let's face it, was a co-founder of the Peace Corps. I mean, obviously, you feel strongly about international concerns. So did you feel kind of misrepresented by this ad in any way?
I sweated over that ad. The basic proposition that you can't be strong abroad if you're weak at home, a John Kennedy quote, was my theme. It never was intended to mean we should be weak abroad, we should not do things abroad. It meant that you're not going to do it abroad effectively if you're weak at home. I agree that ad can mislead, and I went to some length after my election to say that the message was not that we should not respond to the needs of the former Soviet Union or Eastern Europe. In fact, I was one of the leaders in the Senate pressing for a rapid, strong response to help them. But I was saying it's wrong, it's right that we respond to the needs of the people of Bangladesh and to the Kurds, but it's wrong that we don't put the same energy and resources and commitment to our own problems. And I did take some responsibility afterwards to try to say it wasn't an isolationist message.
Now, I want to ask you something else about the political process and becoming a part of it. You've spent most of your career either serving in state or federal administrations or in academia, again, as president of Bryn Mawr College or a professor there. And especially in the world of academia, discourse is a very important part of what you do, and it can be done over the course of more time than you're allowed in politics, especially when you're on the stump. And especially now in politics, all candidates are advised to speak in sound bites so that it can get on the TV news and get quoted in the press. How did you learn how to do that when you needed to do that?
Just had to do it by practice. you were counseling me to be shorter in a conversation, and so was James Carville, and so was my wife, always, for many years. So when you have to do it, you do it. But also now we can break through. One of the things of this campaign that's promising, I think, is candidates are now breaking through to talk shows where you can talk this way.
So you like that?
I love it, and so did I do a lot of it in the campaign, and so, of course, did Clinton and Perot and, in the end, even Bush.
Your successful campaign is now seen as a kind of a precursor of what was to come later with Bill Clinton's successful campaign. Did you feel like a test case when you were campaigning, and did you feel that, like, somehow the Democratic Party's future was resting on your shoulders in some way because your election was being watched as a harbinger of what was to come?
I had a feeling of that because Thornburg was the candidate, and he'd come from being attorney general, and he was sent off from the White House. His launching pad was the White House when he announced that he was going to do it. And however, my campaign colleagues, James Carville, kept saying, above all, don't make this a referendum on Bush. Don't ever attack Bush. He's 80% favorable. Stick to Thornburg and Washington Insider, but don't take on Bush. And I didn't until the last week of the campaign, and I got carried away at a rally in Washington, Pennsylvania. Someone said, Senator, your election's going to mean the first day of the end of the Bush administration. And I went up and began my speech with that, and the audience went wild with applause. And the AP picked it up and put it in every paper in Pennsylvania. Wofford says it's going to be the first day of the end of the Bush administration, referendum on the Bush administration. Carville, Begala, my two sons, lashed me and said, you may have blown it. Don't ever say anything like that again. And in fact, Bush's popularity had fallen and people were sensing the country was on the wrong track. And so I had the pleasure in my victory statement of beginning by saying our election marks the first day of the end of the Bush administration.
My guest is Senator Harris Wofford of Pennsylvania. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Harris Wofford, Democratic senator from Pennsylvania. There's a new edition of his 1980 book of Kennedys and Kings, Making Sense of the 60s. You were a co-founder of the Peace Corps, and now as a senator, you've proposed a service corps. What are you proposing, and what connections do you see between that and the Peace Corps?
Well, it is a proposal to bring the idea of the Peace Corps home on a big scale. We had that dream, you might say, in the 60s, a million-strong Peace Corps in America. In those days, we probably thought of it like one big United States Peace Corps at home, run by a director of the Peace Corps. Nowadays, I wouldn't think of it that way. I would think of percolation up from all kinds of different corps. The Wall Street Journal today has an article on a Durham, North Carolina youth corps on its front page. Philadelphia has a youth service corps. One of the best, maybe the best in the country, is the Boston City Year, which has diversity by design, half college-bound, half not college-bound, half minority, half not, a real experience in integration. There are hundreds of little youth service corps. A student at Princeton started Teach for America, which has 1,000 volunteer teachers that are in action. And I would have a system like the GI Bill. And more important, I think this is what Clinton has in mind, a system like the GI Bill in which you get a minimum allowance for a year or two of service and an educational bonus afterwards that'll help you pay for college. But you can take that voucher, in a sense, to a whole range of options in service. And if you get admitted, then you get your expenses and the bonus if you complete it. And in other words, a great diversity of service programs and an invitation to colleges and churches and businesses and civic groups to find out how to tap the talent of young people and put it to work to improve our communities.
Is your primary goal with this to improve communities or to provide like training and temporary employment for young people, or a combination of the two?
Well, I would say a combination of the two, and it's very important that the psychological key to why the experience in a service corps can be so important, in addition to getting an esprit de corps that you get in that kind of an intense program if it's well led, is the sense that you're needed. A young youth service corps man in Philadelphia had been in a street gang. I probed, why are you in it? And he said, finally, after joshing, well, this work, I might not get killed in a different gang. He said, I joined this because all my life people have been coming to do good against me, to help me. Good people have come to our housing project. It's the first time in my life anybody asked me to do something. And I listened to him and I said, that is exactly what the first Peace Corps volunteer asked that on the White House lawn said when they said, why did you, the silent generation, and hundreds of thousands volunteer to go to the Peace Corps? And he said, nobody had ever asked me to do anything patriotic, unselfish, or for the common good before. Kennedy asked. And I think that's what young people, in fact, that's what all of us want, is to be needed.
No, the way our American political system works, if you want people to vote for your bill, you've got to kind of vote for their bill, too. That's often what happens behind the scenes in Congress.
You say that, but yeah. I've been in Congress a year and a half.
And I've never
and
been.
No one has ever come up and
Is
proposed
right?
anything like that to me. No one has ever said, I'll support your Civilian Conservation Corps, Service Corps bill if you'll support my bill.
So are you saying that we have a stereotype that doesn't exist, or that you've just managed to avoid that?
I didn't try to avoid it. I'm open to the whole experience. I'm just saying in a year and a half, there's never been a conversation like that with another senator.
Has anyone tried to get your vote on something?
Certainly. Just the way I've helped build with Senator Boren and with Senator Nunn and Mikulski. I've tried to build a coalition for the idea of national service. I'm sort of known as Mr. National Service, and I am working both sides of the aisle, and I was elated when I discovered that Senator Domenici was interested in it, and Senator Warner and Senator Dole particularly. I've been working very hard on that, and I'll have to work, I've been working and will be working all out to build a coalition to get national health care through.
What are your hopes for the near future for health care reform?
I take Bill Clinton very seriously in what he says, and he has said that within the first 100 days, the President of the United States will propose to Congress a fundamental, comprehensive health care reform bill. I expect to be in the shaping of that bill, and I was with Governor Clinton in New Jersey at the Merck Company, along with Jay Rockefeller. We were the two he had there by his side as he launched his health care proposals. I will fight all out to get those through. It won't get passed in the first 100 days. There will be hearings. There will be a battle royal. But the difference now is, why I'm full of hope, is that we have a president who will fight for it the way Roosevelt fought for Social Security. He will call the players to the table. He will preside over the bargaining when necessary. And I think within the first year of the Clinton administration, we will have a major health care reform bill passed.
Do you think it will be like the health care reform bill that you've proposed?
We've all agreed to put our own bills aside, but it's very much in his thinking is very much in line with my approach, yes.
Can you give us a sketch of what you think the health care reform might look like, or are you not prepared to do that until there's more discussions and more consensus?
Well, we came close to a consensus in the Senate that the public and the press doesn't realize. We had some months ago agreed to put our individual bills aside and look at the ingredients that needed to be put together. And we were really very close to a Democratic consensus before the election adjournment came. I think what Governor Clinton is asking for, which is what I want, is a combination of a national budgeting, a national package of health care rights that you have all your life, that you have a computer or electronic card that plugs you into them, and that would help with a single, simplified, inexpensive billing system that could go from job to job and from state to state, and that we have a voice nationally, a National Health Commission that looks at the future of health, AIDS, projecting the aid and aging issue, two different issues, all the complex problems we have a national center that looks where we're going in healthcare and shows us how we can stop the out-of-control costs that are going up for everybody, for our federal budget, families, and the rest, but that the delivery system and the way you organize this not be a federally run bureaucracy, but maybe we even get rid of the present bureaucracy and it be locally driven.
I would imagine that on some level, you're kind of standing back from your experience in politics and always looking at it and analyzing it. Do you know what I mean? Analyzing the American political process and everything. And I'm wondering if on some level you're grateful that you got to spend some time under a Republican administration and now you'll be working under a Democratic administration, just for the sake of kind of intellectually comparing the two, even though I know you have partisan interests as a Democrat and will probably prefer serving under a Democratic administration for that reason.
Well, I think the experience that I needed to have and that most other senators, for example, have is what it's like to be in opposition, in effect, and to know that, well, we got one bill through over the veto of the president out of 37, and to know the government of the United States doesn't work when you have that kind of gridlock and each end of Pennsylvania Avenue is blaming the other. I think it's set the stage for a real response from Congress to say, there's no longer any excuse. We have a united Democratic administration. You better work together as a team. You better not blow this. You'd better not miss this opportunity. The ending of the gridlock gives us a chance to prove that government can work. And we have that responsibility now. Some ways it was easier to be an oppositionist. I could criticize President Bush and, you know, it was easy to just stand there talking and fighting. But now we really have the possibility of getting these things done, national health insurance, for example. And if we fail in the next year or two, there's going to be a depression of the spirit in the country. And just as I rode in on a wave of discontent, if the discontent gets deeper, I'll ride out. I come up in 2 years. So I'll be in, just as I was a little test of the fact that people wanted change, I might be the first bird, the first duck that gets shot down if we don't succeed. And it puts a tremendous challenge to the Democrats to draw together, to be a team, to not just be little barons speaking for ourselves, but to get the common good first again.
I just want to ask you something that really isn't related to politics at all, and it goes back to your childhood. For 6.5 months, your grandmother took you out of school when you were a kid to travel with you around the world, which is a very unusual situation for a kid, something I'm sure a lot of kids wish had happened to them. Why did she do that? What was your parents' reaction? Yeah,
well, my parents let me do it, and they paid for the tour. I was still half fare when we bought the tickets and 12 years old when I went. And they later joked that they blamed that trip and my grandmother from Little Rock, Arkansas, who was a Southern Democrat, for turning me into a Democrat. It was a Republican family. And the experience of hearing Mussolini in Rome take Italy out of the League of Nations from his speech in the Piazza Venezia, of seeing Arabs shooting at Jews in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, of seeing Gandhi in the streets of Bombay, of seeing going through the bombed-out streets of Shanghai after the Japanese had taken over, that experience, one, interested me in the world in a deep way that led to the Peace Corps in some sense, or my interest in it. And secondly, my Republican father joked that all that time with my Democrat Little Rock grandmother turned me into a Democrat.
Harris Wofford, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Good to be with you, Terry.
Senator Harris Wofford, there's a new edition of his book of Kennedys and Kings, Making Sense of the 60s. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Irish writer and director Neil Jordan. His new movie about an IRA terrorist, The Crying Game, has opened in this country to rave reviews. Terrence Rafferty of The New Yorker says the film has the sure grip and the unstoppable momentum of a dream. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two vintage TV shows that haven't been seen in 30 years. One features the character James Bond before he made it to the big screen. The other stars Carl Reiner in an early version of the role he later wrote for Dick Van Dyke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Two leading U.S. senators just back from a trip to the former Soviet Union say that President Bush and President-elect Bill Clinton must not allow U.S. policy to drift during a time of transition. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Democrat Sam Nunn, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Republican Richard Lugar, a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said Bush and Clinton must work together now on arms control, trade, and development of free markets, warning there's too much at stake in the former Soviet Union to declare a recess on foreign policy now. As an example of the dangers, Nunn said senior officials in Belarus reported they had intercepted several efforts to smuggle uranium abroad. Nunn said that leads to the question of whether some shipments got through. Nunn and Lugar expressed concern about Ukraine's commitment to the START treaty. Negotiations have stalled on a follow-on agreement to slash strategic nuclear weapons by a further 50%. And plans for the U.S. to purchase weapons-grade uranium must also be finalized. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Even as residents of parts of Texas began to travel on snowbound roads again, highways were closed in parts of Kansas by high winds and heavy snow. Interstate 40 in Texas opened again about midday after being the scene yesterday of a number of traffic accidents. The early winter storm tied up rush hour traffic in Kansas City this morning, and dangerous driving conditions have been forecast across the Plain States. The National Weather Service says that Dodge City, Kansas, had its heaviest snow during a 24-hour period since 1929. In South Africa, African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has agreed to meet with his main political rival in hopes of ending a stalemate in talks on South Africa's political future. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
No date has been set for the summit between Mandela and Inkatha Freedom Party leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi, but the announcement that the two men would finally get together has raised expectations that their meeting will be followed by a resumption of multi-party talks on ending South Africa's white minority rule. Those talks have been stalled for months by a series of disputes between the ANC, Inkatha, and the government. Top ANC leaders who met for 3 days of closed-door talks this week said they want an elected interim government in place within a year to begin the transition to a new democratic form of rule. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Officials in Berlin say that Germany's largest bank plans to cut nearly 9,000 jobs. Most of these job cuts will be made in Western Germany. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 17 points to close at 3,266.26. This is NPR News. Officials in Washington have confirmed that the State Department is looking into new leads in the controversy over the pre-election search of Bill Clinton's passport files. At the same time, government officials will neither confirm nor deny a New York Times report that new evidence indicates that the White House may have been involved in the search. A State Department spokesman says that on the day that State Department officials announced their findings last year, Last week, they indicated the case was still open in the event there were further leads. With Tennessee Senator Al Gore now elected vice president, a Senate seat in the volunteer state will have to be filled. Sean Jacobs of member station WMOT reports it's unclear now who will be appointed to fill out the Gore Senate term.
Tennessee's Democratic Governor Ned Ray McWhorter will make the appointment as soon as Gore officially resigns. But yesterday, the man considered to be McWhorter's top choice, 8th District Tennessee Congressman John Tanner, took himself out of consideration. McWhorter says now it's a whole new ballgame.
I want to send somebody to the United States Senate, first of all, that'll represent the people of Tennessee and represent them well. And next, I want to send somebody to the United States Senate that will support President Clinton and support his programs.
McWhorter says he's looking for what he calls a conservative to moderate Democrat. The top contenders now appear to be 4th District Congressman Jim Cooper or possibly Bart Gordon from the 6th District. Whoever the governor selects will have to run for election in 1994. For National Public Radio, I'm Sean Jacobs in Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
According to a new survey, fewer senior executives were hired in the third quarter of the year because of tough U.S. economic times. The International Index of Executive Vacancies says that there was a 12% drop in demand for senior executives during the third quarter of the year and a 7% drop during the second quarter. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Neil Jordan has temporarily given up on Hollywood, and I'm glad he has. It leaves him free to make idiosyncratic films. Jordan is an Irish writer and director best known for the movie Mona Lisa. After the success of that film, he came to the States to direct the comedy High Spirits. His spirits sunk when he lost control of the final cut. His next film, a remake of We're No Angels, starring Robert De Niro and Sean Penn, was a box office disappointment. Jordan headed back to Ireland and made the independent film The Miracle. His new movie, The Crying Game, was described by New Yorker film critic Terence Rafferty as amazing, a daring poetic imagining of what it means never to feel the same about anything again. I had the pleasure of seeing this film before I knew anything about it, and if you decide to see it, I'd like you to experience the same surprise as I did. So I'm not going to give away any of the plot twists and character revelations. I asked Neil Jordan if it's hard for him to discuss the movie without revealing too much.
No, it's not really, because, I can talk about the themes in the film without talking about the plot, you know. But there are several, there are three or four plot points which the thing turns on, and they change your perception of what you've watched before. And I think half the pleasure of the movie is audience actually discovering these for themselves.
Let's talk a little bit about the beginning of the movie. I think we can discuss this.
Yeah.
In the first part of the film, a woman is seduced by a black British soldier, played by Forrest Whitaker. And then she takes him hostage. It turns out she's a member of the IRA.
Mm.
And they're giving the British Army 3 days to release IRA prisoners in return for the release of this soldier.
Yeah. Did this ever happen?
the main character, played by Stephen Ray, ends up talking to the prisoner and building some kind of relationship with him.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what, if any, relationship you've had either with the IRA or with friends or acquaintances who've been members of the IRA.
Well, I think every Irish person has. You know, they've got it in their family. You know, my grandfather was involved in some ways in the earlier in the old IRA, in the 1960 and 1921 period, you know. And it's quite close to living memory, that is, you know. And I think this conflict has been going on for about 20 years in the north of Ireland, so I think Irish people do know it. They know it instinctively in themselves, and quite a few Irish people know people who've gotten involved, gotten into trouble.
In the beginning of the film, you know, you really think about the kind of temperament that it takes to be able to think of a person as a symbol of what they represent, you know, to think of a person as a symbol of the British Army. Did you get into a lot of political, ethical arguments with friends about the IRA and what its tactics were and what was too much?
No, I didn't. I mean, I just take it as read. You know, I take it as read that they are people who do things. They use violence for political ends, you know what I mean? And they're often portrayed as psychopaths, but the problem with the IRA is not that they're psychopaths. The problem is that they're not, that they're actually, they've got a very cogent program, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really just wanted to make the film as honestly, I just wanted to observe these characters as honestly as I could and ask no questions and make no judgments, you know? I didn't want to villainize anybody, either a British Army person or an IRA person or anybody, you know. So the challenge for me really was just in actually seeing them as human beings, and that itself has turned out to be kind of a political hot potato, you know, because you're not meant to be allowed to do that.
How has it become a political hot potato?
Well, in Britain, you know, in Ireland, any examination of these issues at all causes some controversy, you know. But and particularly showing a central character like Fergus, the character played by Stephen Ray, showing a character like him who has qualms about what he's doing, you know, who has a conscience and who has got feelings, you know. People would prefer to demonise the entire movement, I suppose, you know, because it makes them uncomfortable.
You know, you said you wanted to create characters without passing judgment on them, and I think that's one of the themes that's run through several of your films, you know, not passing judgment on people politically, sexually, you know, whether the characters are involved with crime or a prostitute in some of your earlier work. Is that something that comes natural to you?
What, not to
pass
judgment?
Not passing judgment. You know, just accepting people for what they are.
Well, no, I like to take characters that otherwise would be... I'm obsessed with redemption, you know, the redemption of characters who would seem to be irredeemable, you know, the humanization of characters who seem to be inhuman, you know, or seem to be beyond our normal kind of bourgeois acceptance level, you know. And I suppose seeing heroism, you know, seeing heroism and dignity in areas that it's not normally seen.
That your interest in redemption, does that come at all from a religious upbringing?
Well, I've got this Catholic baggage somewhere in the back of my brain, you know. I mean, I don't practice it, but it's somewhere there.
Was there a lot of religious imagery or, you know, redemptive symbolism in your upbringing?
Oh, yeah, no, I grew up surrounded by holy pictures. Of course I did. You know, every Irish kid did. I mean, I grew up in a medieval kind of mental world, really. Oh. The Catholic Church, I mean, I think everybody knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating kind of wonderfully perverse, you know, system of kind of imagery, really. Blood and suffering. It's the images that stick with me rather than the moral system in a way, you know, but the images are still there.
Now, and another thing that runs through some of your movies, including this new movie, is the impossible, the miraculous. Does that come to you?
Well, I come from a country that's full of fairy tales. You know, I come from a country that's full of a kind of a verbal culture, where the kind of peasant folklore, or the peasant imagination, still is quite close to the, you know, still is a very important part of the culture. You know, I mean. My father, we came from Roscommon, a small farm in Roscommon. He just moved to Dublin, you know, when I was born, you know, so that this kind of peasant thing is still quite strong, and even if you grow up in Dublin. Irish people tend to be very, you know, they tend to be very impatient with reality. You know, they're far happier dealing with their imaginations, you know, and they're not very good with reality in many ways. And I suppose that all that sort of stuff informs my work as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me quote something that Terence Rafferty said about your new movie, and this was in the New Yorker magazine. He compared it to, quote, emerging from the dark woods horror of a grim fairy tale.
Yes.
I mean, your movie Company of Wolves, one of your early films, was actually based on fairy tales.
On a grim fairy tale. Well, it was based on the Little Red Riding Hood, wasn't it?
Yeah. So why do fairy tales have that kind of resonance?
Well, they go deep. You know, fairy tales go very deep. They go... I mean, they're simple stories. What I love about fairy tales is they don't explain themselves, you know. They talk about a little girl walking down a dark wood and, you know, or a princess who sleeping under a mattress with a pea or whatever. You know, they're little parables, and they don't offer any explanation whatsoever, any rational explanation, you know. And they kind of work on a rational and a irrational and subliminal level, you know. And I think they give us access to areas of our unconscious that we normally don't get to.
In an interview with Film Comment a few years ago, you said, I connect movies with sex and isolation. I connect them with forbidden things, rich, strange things that don't happen in real life. Is that connected to what you're saying about fairy tales?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, films are larger than life. You know, they do work on us in a way that is bigger than our rational, you know, the way we rationally explain them away, you know. When I first was struck by movies when I was a kid, I suppose they... You know, they spoke to me in ways that I didn't fully understand. You know, they spoke to me, parts of me that I didn't fully understand. And I suppose I try to make the films that I make now, I try to make them speak in the same way.
Were you allowed to see any movie you wanted to?
When I was a kid, no. No, I was... I suppose it was a kind of forbidden pleasure because I grew up in a very strict household, you know, and the movies that I was allowed to go to the films about once every 2 weeks, which is... But to most American kids, I would say, seemed like an extraordinary kind of confinement, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But, and yeah, my parents used to only let me go to see Westerns and war movies, you know. And the school every now and then would drag you out to a religious epic.
My guest is Neil Jordan. He wrote and directed the new movie, The Crying Game. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and director Neil Jordan. His movies include Mona Lisa, The Company of Wolves, The Miracle, and the new movie, The Crying Game. Another theme in some of your movies is loving somebody who you're really not supposed to love for one reason or another.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd really like to know why that is a theme that is obviously a really important one for you. I mean, it obviously has some kind of real personal resonance for you.
Loving somebody that you're not supposed to love. Well, I probably do it all the time. No, it's more actually being... I see, like, I suppose, the operations of the heart, you know? Romantic obsession, you know, as a... That's a hugely disruptive force, isn't it, you know? And it's probably a more important force than... people ever admit to themselves, you know. I always think of that little scene in Citizen Kane, you know, where the old guy is talking to the investigator, and he says they're talking about Rosebud, and he tells that story about that girl he saw on the boat in Stratton Island Ferry in a white dress when he was 20 years old, and how he never even knew her name or never met her since, but never a day goes past but that he thinks of that woman. Do you remember that little bit?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think romantic obsessions are like that, you know what I mean? They're actually, we think that we're obsessed with the person in question, you know, we think we understand what drives us, but actually they're about something far deeper in ourselves that actually possibly can never be satisfied, you know.
The Stephen Ray character comes to London after a series of events, which I won't give away, but what was it like for you when you first came to London?
It was very like that.
After growing up in Ireland.
It was very like that. I worked in construction. I had the best job in the world, actually. It was knocking down buildings, you know. I'd recommend it to anybody who was pathologically inclined, you know.
Pathologically inclined?
Oh. No, you get a huge amount of anger if you're given a lump hammer and told to go in an 18th-century room and tear it to pieces, you know. It's good. But I lived in that world of immigrant Irish labour, you know, which is, so I put, when I wrote these scenes where Stephen Ray goes to London, I put a lot of my own experience in there, my own memories, you know. Little details.
Well, he becomes very anonymous, which is kind of good for him since he's on the lam. But you were not hiding out from the authorities. Did you feel more anonymous, and how did you like it?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, traditionally Irish people go to London to escape. You know, I mean, I grew up in the 50s. It was a very hidebound little society, you know. And to go to London was a great escape, you know, because you're in a culture that doesn't know you. You know, nobody knows your name. Nobody knows who you are. You could be anybody. You know, you could change your name if you wanted. You could... change your hair, change everything, change your sex if you wanted. You know, it was that kind of place to me. I mean, to Irish people, it is that kind of place.
What did you go to London to escape from?
I went to London to escape from, I suppose, the confines of a rather rigid, kind of rather rigid Catholic society, really.
So once
I also went to get a job. Actually, I couldn't get a job in Ireland.
So when you got to London, were things ever not what they seemed to be? Were there things that fooled you or disappointed you or surprised you?
When I got to London?
I'm thinking of like when your main character gets to London, he's confused by some things and fooled by some things. And I was wondering if you were confused or fooled.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he reads all the signals wrong, doesn't he? I mean, he's in a bar, he doesn't know the nature of the bar. He meets a girl, he doesn't know the nature of the girl. He's He's a country boy in a big city, you know, which is exactly what I was, you know, I was a country boy in a big city. And, you know, but I suppose naivety carries you through a multitude, really, doesn't it, you know? A certain kind of naivety and innocence enables one to go into any situation, no matter how troublesome or potentially dangerous it may be, and to emerge unscathed, you know. And to a certain extent, Fergus is like that in the film. I know he's a killer and all that sort of stuff, but at heart, he's got a certain innocence, hasn't he?
In several of your films, there's a song that is very associated with the movie, Mona Lisa, Nat Cole's recording of Mona Lisa. In The Miracle, it was the song Stardust. And in your new movie, it's the record The Crying Game. Now, I didn't know this record or the song before seeing the movie.
Yeah, it wasn't a hit in America. Sure it wasn't. It was a hit for about 5 minutes in England in 1967.
Oh.
Or maybe it was 1969. I remember it anyway myself very strongly when I was a kid.
What's the association?
The association with the song?
Yeah.
Well, it was a guy called Dave Berry, and he brought a strange theatricality to his performances. I used to see him on television, you know. He used to do these strange kind of theatrical acts. It was a bit as if you'd seen, he kind of predated David Bowie, you know, that kind of rather camp kind of thing that David Bowie does,
mm-hmm.
used to do. And when I was a kid, I found the song fascinating, you know. It had a cheap, schmaltzy kind of poetry about it, you know, and that said something to me. And if I'm writing a script or I'm making a film, I find this, you know, there's many uses for a song, you know, apart from just the normal promotional ones. I mean, the thing about a song is it actually can, you know, build up the whole emotional world, it can present the whole emotional world of the character, like the Nat King Cole song in Mona Lisa. It told you exactly where Bob Hoskins was coming from, you know. It told you exactly the kind of 50s romanticism, you know, that, you know, this obsessed kind of romantic guy he is or could become, you know. In terms of The Crying Game, when I wrote the character Dill, I just always thought of it as her song. You know, it somehow expressed her character.
Neil Jordan wrote and directed the new film, The Crying Game.
One day soon I'm gonna tell the moon about the crying game.
This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Coming up on All Things Considered, the news from Little Rock. The president-elect has named those people who will be doing the hiring in the coming Clinton administration. We will also have a conversation with Robert Reich. He is the man who is trying to put together recommendations for President-elect Clinton on what to do about the economy. Plans that may change in view of relatively good economic news out today. We will have a report from France, where French farmers are still angry and still demonstrating. Out west, the weather's terrible. We talked to some people who are stuck in a truck stop in Oklahoma. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
This weekend, both Nick at Night and Superstation TBS are presenting primetime telecasts of old TV rarities that were shown only once and haven't been seen in more than 30 years. TV critic David Bianculli says neither of them is any good, but both are fascinating.
One of these blasts from the past is shown this Sunday on cable Superstation TBS. It's one of the first episodes of a Golden Age anthology series called Climax. This one is from 1954, when Climax was still being produced live from Hollywood. And what makes this episode so unusual is that it's an adaptation of Ian Fleming's Casino Royale, 8 full years before 007 would first appear on film. And what an awful adaptation this is. In this Casino Royale, the hero is completely Americanized. That means there's no 007 designation because he's not on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And no martinis, shaken, not stirred. This James Bond is a Scotch drinker. And worst of all, he sometimes answers to the name of Bond. Jimmy Bond. Barry Nelson plays Bond and loses. Linda Christian plays the femme fatale, and she's no good either. In fact, the only passable performance comes from the villain, played by Peter Lorre. In this scene, he tries to pry information out of Bond with a pair of pliers, using them to crush the tied-up hero's toes. This could make James Bond lame, but this James Bond already is.
Excruciating, huh? Look, Mr. Bond, if you continue like this, I have to start on poor Valerie. You leave me no choice. I cannot let you destroy me.
I've already destroyed you.
You think so, huh?
I'm no hero. I don't like pain. But I can tell you one thing right now. You won't get anything out of me. Pain and killing's part of my job.
And of mine, too, Mr. Bond.
And I'll bet you love it.
The week's other vintage offering is a much more important TV artifact. It's the original pilot version of what became known, with a different cast and different title, as The Dick Van Dyke Show. This first version was called Head of the Family, and the only cast member from that pilot to reappear in the successful series was Carl Reiner. On The Dick Van Dyke Show, Reiner played pompous TV host Alan Brady. But in Head of the Family, which Reiner also created and wrote, he had the role of Rob Petrie. For the most part, Reiner's original co-stars are rather unfamiliar, and so are the interpretations of their characters. There's Barbara Britton as a blonde and chipper Laura, Morty Gunty as a young and nerdy Buddy Sorrell, and Gary Morgan as a whiny little Richie. The shocker is to see Sylvia Miles as Sally Rogers, looking and sounding a lot like Rose Marie. For a taste, here's Rob bringing Richie to work, much to the surprise of Buddy and Sally.
Gives, Rob. What's with the kid?
He can't function with a child.
Please, now, as a personal favor, let him stay here. He has no idea how his father earns a living.
And you want him to find out?
It's a very good idea for him to find out where the money for the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches come from. Look, he's a good kid. You won't even know he's here. Rich, come, sit over here. Sit here and you'll see how Daddy writes the Alan Sturdy Show.
You need them to help you, Daddy?
Well, no, I don't. Yes, I do. I could write alone, but it's difficult to write a show alone every week.
So you need them?
Yes, I need them. But I'm the main one. I'm in charge. I'm like Casey Stengel. You understand?
No. Rob, can we get started working? I got a blind date tonight with someone I may marry.
CBS televised that pilot in the summer of 1960 just to get some of its losses back, but it hasn't been seen since. The network felt Reiner was too ethnic for Rob, even though the character was based on Reiner's life, which, if you think about it, makes little Richie actually Rob Reiner. But Carl Reiner, instead of walking away from the Head of the Family concept, cast and taped another version, named it after his new leading man, and CBS put it on the air a year later. The rest is history. And if it's history you want, TV has it this weekend, whether it's Oh, Rob, or 007.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Audrey Voblaitis, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for the Thanksgiving holiday, we go into the Fresh Air archives to bring you an interview and concert with the great folk musician Doc Watson. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Loudon Wainwright's new album. I'm Terry Gross, and we hope you can spend some of the holiday with us on the next Fresh Air.